This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 25. And I'm delighted to be joined on the show today by Gonzalo Vasconcelos, CEO and founder of Syndicate Room, who are one of my must-know-about equity crowdfunding platforms. As I've mentioned on the show before, crowdfunding seems to me to occupy this triangle whose three vertices are SPIVs, pile them high and sell them cheap, and professional. No firm, I believe, resides precisely at any of the vertices right now, and the whole thing is evolving. Maybe I should be clear what I mean by professional. There are plenty of professional firms out there, but I mean more professional in the way that established stock exchanges are. The London Stock Exchange or Deutsche Börse, for example, I would say are pretty professional. Fintech as a whole hasn't got anywhere near there yet, although as we heard in LFP 023, I think B2B foreign exchange is the most professionalized subsector of fintech. Syndicate Room are definitely one of the few fintech equity crowdfunding firms nearest the professional vertex, in my opinion. Their interesting business model innovation is that all of their deals are led by an experienced angel investor who has a personal stake in the deal, far higher than you or I, who in essence co-invest alongside them. Thus, he has conducted his own due diligence, etc., etc., before investing. Furthermore, the vital issue of pricing has been somewhat left blank by the marketplace as a whole. In conventional grown-up markets, this is arrived at by plenty of interaction, basically between professional sellers and professional buyers. Even then, often it goes wrong when measured by secondary market performance. So it's much more challenging in these illiquid markets such as equity crowdfunding. You never know whether it was a fair price or not. However, back to the essence of Syndicate Room's twist, once again a lead angel has been at the crux of setting the price. This, I feel, is incredibly powerful. Anyway, it's all in motion, and who better to ask than not just the founder of one of the leading firms, and one with an interesting twist, but also a contributor to Forbes. So we look forward to eloquence and fluency from Gonzalo today. Or failing that, a lot of time in post-production, after which all guests appear suave and airbrushed. Well, they do if they bribe me. So let's get on with the show. Hi, Gonzalo. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
Hi, Mike. Thank you for inviting me. Wow, Syndicate Room being one of your must-know-about equity crowdfunding platforms. Knowing that you ask all the tough questions in alternative finance, that I'll take it as a huge compliment, to be honest.
Exactly. I'm a great believer in transparency, as you know, and as I'm always very transparent with the listeners, it essentially it's paper complimented up front. Actually, I haven't received the check yet, but you tell me it's under the So going back to your background, nobody was actually born in fintech, and source of all information on everything, LinkedIn, tells me that you used to do something useful like civil engineering and big buildingy things like that. So how do you go from something very physical about digging holes in the ground and putting bridges across the Mediterranean or whatever it was to fintech?
Yes, so I was born and raised in Portugal, where I ended up studying civil engineering and actually worked as a civil engineer there for a while, and ended up deciding to move to London to do a master's in civil engineering and business management at Imperial College.
And what was it about civil engineering that attracted you to it in the first place?
Just being useful, as you said, and helpful, and actually building stuff. I think that was the really exciting part, was building stuff and innovating. And then end up staying in London, working in a variety of roles in civil engineering, project management, consultancy, etc. Then end up starting my own company back in 2007, until I end up moving up to Cambridge to do an MBA at the Judge Business School.
And how was that? I think the Judge Institute postdates my time at Cambridge, and I think I was definitely one of those sniffy ones that thought management and business, that's not a real subject. But I believe they do it quite well, even if it's real or not real. Who knows? I mean, geography is not a real subject, but anyway.
No, I think it's definitely real. I think it was very interesting, but there's nothing like the practical hands-on experience to actually learn about it.
A number of people on the show have done MBAs and all that kind of stuff, and a number of them have found it very useful, but I think the ones for whom it's most useful, they're kind of people who naturally have got their hands dirty or been in IT or been in business and had this other skill set. I can perfectly imagine that you can go through any good MBA and just come out knowing a bunch of facts, like if you did history.
Yeah.
And actually not really being a particularly good businessman as such.
Potentially, yes. So with my civil engineering background in terms of engineering and then doing the management course really helped me on developing my skills. But more importantly, It was actually what gave me the idea for Syndicate Room. It was the very, very beginning of Syndicate Room.
Right, or the Civil Engineering, or the Judge Institute, or
both? The Judge Business School, yes, right. And my MBA.
Okay, going back to the Syndicate Room, as I say, just from my amateur perspective, you have this interesting twist, and I think it's not always particularly understood what the implications of that twist are. You know, you'll do a talk somewhere and say, oh yes, and it's led by an angel, everyone goes, oh, you know, tick boxes led by an angel, so what? But actually, that's really very, very different from those platforms who don't, because, you know, there's just a massive asymmetry there, because you've got someone who's cocks on the block, or whatever the politically correct, socially neutral gender phrase is, and they really, really care. And actually, the place where we're recording this today, I'm a minority investor, and there are lots of minority investors, and you know, it's all been going very well for 20 years, but it's a very different kettle of fish when you've got loads of tiny investors in a project as opposed to a big one. I mean, I sat on the board as well, but you know, not that that necessarily makes much difference if the chief executive still got control. So how did you come up with this whole sort of angel-y thing, and did you fully at the time appreciate how powerful it was? I mean, you know what it's like, you have an idea, I think that's a great idea, but then like a year or two later you go, actually that really was quite a good idea. You know, when you see it in practice a few times.
Yeah, I think entrepreneurs tend to have this bad habit of thinking that their ideas are really powerful from the word go.
Yeah. Because you've got to be mad to push ahead and make it all happen, all that kind of stuff. You know? So you've got to believe in it.
Quite. Now, to be honest, so I started the idea behind Syndicate Room when I was working with, I was doing my MBA and started working a lot with business angels and started seeing some of the deals they were investing in, their own money.
What year are we talking now about?
So this was back in 2011 and started seeing some really interesting innovations passing right in front of my eyes and thinking, ah, that's really interesting. I can see this going somewhere. I would quite like to invest, to be honest. To which the business angel said, yeah, sure, how much do you want to invest? I said, I don't know, £1,000 maybe. For them to invest anything less than £25,000, it doesn't even exist.
Yeah, they wouldn't get out of bed for it.
Exactly. So they just look at me and said, well, actually, no, not quite.
Little boy, go to the casino first, make some real money and come back and play with us.
Yeah, a little bit. Not in an arrogant way.
But yeah. It's just like the stakes for playing on the poker table are X and you haven't got X, Johnny.
Correct. And I became that annoying kid, just kept on asking questions. Well, why not? Why can't I invest £1,000? And the real reason behind it was just the existing process was just not efficient enough. You know, by the time I meet the lawyers, sign the documents, transfer the money, the lawyers check if the money has been transferred, you know, £1,000 has been spent in legal fees alone. So what I ended up going for was to create Syndicate Room, which is effectively a process that is very, very efficient for people to invest from £1,000 upwards.
I see. And did Crowdcube and Cedars exist at that time? Did you have them to sort of, you know, aim off? Which I think, oh, that's a good idea, but I'm going to aim to the left or the right of those?
Crowdcube had just started. Cedars hadn't started yet.
Right. Oh, so it was very, very early days.
And then Cedars started immediately after, as I had formed the idea.
Yeah. Karen was on the show in January, although she's now, amazingly enough, Karen Kerrigan, running the Marathon de Sable in the Sahara, 156 miles or kilometres in a week. She described herself as not a good runner. It was a rather terrifying idea. I wonder how she would describe herself as she was. So, okay, it was all kind of forming at the time, and you were really coming not so much from the kind of, I'm going to create a platform, as actually there's this process and I could streamline it and see where it goes.
Which effectively is the platform.
Yeah,
the platform.
Which then becomes the platform.
Exactly. And it was much more than that. It was just to see, I was talking to people and I was asking how many of them would actually be interested in investing in this type of deals. And there was a huge amount of appetite for that, but virtually no access. You know, these deals typically happen offline, completely away from most people's eyes.
Yes, they're not visible, are they?
So I started with this vision of, okay, let's make them visible and let's allow people to invest, sophisticated investors from £1,000 upwards.
Right. Okay, well, let's come back to Syndicate Room later in the show. The interesting thing we were talking about when we had lunch recently, which is your main song and dance, is the future of equity crowdfunding. As I say, it's all in motion at the moment. It's evolving very rapidly. In terms of the industry as a whole, where do you see it going at the moment? What do you think the key issues are?
Well, I see it as absolutely the future of equity finance. It won't replace everything else that is out there, nor it shouldn't, but it definitely is going to become, it already is a pretty big player, and it's going to become more and more important as people warm up to it and understand how it works better and are better informed about what the whole thing means for investors and for companies.
Right. So, I mean, optimism is the prevailing instinct. And as you know, I'm kind of a little bit skeptical of the sugar and spice view of fintech about it, how it's all wonderful and brilliant and that kind of stuff, which is kind of very 2014 for me. 2015 is getting a little bit more hardcore. you know, what do you think it means, just take on the one side, what do you think it means for entrepreneurs in 3 or 5 years' time? You know, new entrepreneurs, what do you think it's going to mean to them to have a hopefully by then stable industry?
So I think one of the main issues with sort of the broader range of private equity industry is the lack of efficiency. Right. It takes forever for companies to raise their funding rounds.
Okay, so for example, the London FinTech podcast decides to expand enormously, and I think, oh, I'll raise some equity. So typically, when am I going to be over and done with that process if I start now?
Oh, we're talking about typically the minimum amount of time, 6 months, potentially up to 12 months.
And in the world which is changing as rapidly as it is at the moment, that's pretty significant. It's a killer.
You know, in 12 months' time, someone else has taken your market.
Yeah.
And on top of that, it's 6 to 12 months that you spend looking for finance rather than looking for followers or for customers or revenues.
Absolutely. So you see the equity crowdfunding's principal thing then as being shortening that timescale?
Well, yes, definitely. You know, there have been many examples of companies raising finance in even under 24 hours.
Although right.
Some might argue that that's a bit too fast and where's the due diligence with that. But the efficiency is definitely there. You know, if you can bring that process that used to take 6 to 12 months down to a month or 2 months, then it's a huge leap forward for companies.
And you mentioned before the streamlining of the legals and all that kind of stuff. You know, without giving your particular sort of secret sauce away, how does the industry as a whole approach that and make it just much more sort of slim and efficient?
So as an industry as a whole, what used to happen was that for every new investor you'd have coming in and joining the round, they would ask for something slightly different and you'd have to go back to your lawyers and change it. And all of that drags the process because then you need to contact all the previous investors asking if they are happy with that change.
I see. So typically, going back to say 10 years ago, I'd try and raise my money for my thing and I'd go around chatting up all sorts of people and I get introduced by other people taking commissions and that. And because I'd end up with, you know, a handful of key investors, then I'm pretty much beholden to them. So if you're one of my key investors putting in 25 grand and you say, look, I don't like this paragraph on page 3, I want it changed completely, then I can see how that ripples around the rest of them.
Yeah, not quite as bad as you make it sound. So business angels tend to be a lot friendlier in terms of the terms. VCs tend to be a lot more aggressive. But then you can see the conflict already because you're having business angels that agree to invest in your company. Then you turn to them and say, oh, by the way, there's another VC coming in, but they want preference shares, which rank above yours.
Yeah.
At which point, the business angels go, actually, we either get preference shares as well, or we're just not in at all. So you have to go back to the VC and say, actually, they also want preference shares. And the VC tells you, well, if they get preference shares, then we're not in.
Right.
And how do you resolve this conflict?
Okay, so it's a different classes of investor then.
And potentially. It used to be. And, you know, it's just the whole process. There are so many different moving parts, it just drags forever.
Yes.
Whereas what equity crowdfunding really brings is a take it or leave it model. So you set the terms as a company and then people either invest or walk away, but generally they cannot really negotiate the terms. So it makes the whole process a lot more efficient, whether it's to fund or actually not to raise the funds because a lot of the projects fail. It becomes a lot more efficient because the company sets the terms. Now there's a downside to that, which is if the company is setting the terms, then that means that the terms will invariably be worse for investors.
Yeah.
And that's where our model comes in because we're the only investor-led platform, which means that the terms are set by the negotiation between the company and the lead investors, just as always been. But then instead of having that tail end of investors always wanting to change the documents, you say, right, if the lead investors putting a very significant amount of money are happy with these terms,
it must be roughly right.
Yeah, exactly.
It must be roughly right.
You removed all the conflict of interest because someone is independently deciding to invest their own money, 100, 200, 300,000 pounds of their own money.
And they've kicked the tires and they've checked the car out because they really, really care.
Because they are putting the money in.
Whereas otherwise, going back to what I call the pricing problem in the equity crowdfunding marketplace, you know, I'm sure it happens to you as well. And maybe sends an email and say, oh, look, I'm raising some money, here it is. And you go to something that's not on your platform and they're selling shares at £1.25. Well, that's interesting, and, you know, but how long is it going to take you to work that out? And this article I wrote on risk in equity crowdfunding recently, I'll put a link in the show notes for Altify News. I was telling some stories from the past, the 1990s. I mean, some very, very, very big companies like Gazprom, for example, where Kleinwalds did the float of that. And if you've been involved at the mega scale in the really, really professional stuff, you realise that there's no such thing as valuation. It's just this kind of black art of trying to get roughly in the right area. And even then, you don't really do it. So I have heard from people with less FX experience which I guess as I'm getting older as most people these days, in the fintech crowdfunding stuff. Oh, we do this and it's the right price. To me, it's anyone says the right price is mad in the first place, you know?
Correct. Because the price, the valuation is such an art, you need a lot of experience.
Yeah.
Because you can't multiply revenues.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You can't look at a balance sheet and play with some numbers and go, actually, it's not 125, it should be 150 or £1.
Exactly. And it's all adjusted to the risk that you're running, not just that company, but your portfolio. And that's where the lead investor really comes in to set that pricing effectively, rather than being just a company. It's a little bit akin to the BBC show Dragon's Den. And if you imagine the entrepreneur that comes up the stairs and says, right, I want £1 million for 5% of the company. And they talk about it. And then what do the dragons do? They go, right, I'll give you £1 million, but I want 40% of your company. They've just negotiated the valuation, and that has a huge effect on their potential returns in the future.
Yes. I mean, I hate the BBC pretty much in general, actually, especially now they've sacked Jeremy Clarkson, but particularly around entrepreneurialism, because I think they do great harm to the economy and the country with their portrayals. So it's all this humiliation TV, as I call it, whether it's Dragon's Den or whether it's Alan Sugar. It's all about being incredibly unkind, trying to screw people, trying to make as much money out of them as possible and trying to humiliate them. Whereas, as you said before, I mean, you're quite right about the negotiation, but I'm just talking about the character of the people. As you said before, the angels, and you've met quite a lot, and I've met quite a lot in my day, most of them are very nice people
who are
very friendly. And if they're going to invest in your business, they want you to be motivated to succeed and help you.
Exactly.
You don't need nasty bastards on your business.
Exactly. So what we need to understand is that the BBC program Dragon's Den is all about the ego of the business angels of the dragons there. So it has a different purpose to it, and it's entertaining. In real life, business angels tend to be not only very friendly, but they tend to be entrepreneurs. You know, they've gone through very rough times. They were very successful one way or another, and now they're helping other entrepreneurs.
Trying to give back.
They try to give back, but they try to make money. They are businessmen,
of course, yes.
And as they should, but they're nowhere near as aggressive as you see on a TV show. And a great example of that is a very, very successful entrepreneur and very successful super angel investor. He's the founder of Appcam, and he co-founded Appcam with another individual who was the business angel for Appcam. And the business angel that invested initially in Appcam, and Appcam being an AIM-listed company worth about £700-800 million, so a very, very large company. When they negotiated the company, the business angel was very clever, because even though that business angel put a lot more money than the founder, because the founder had no money to put in, he actually said, right, but you are keeping a larger stake of the business because I want you to be motivated to succeed. And that way, eventually, the business angel made a huge amount of money on the shares that he got from Appcam, based on the motivation that the entrepreneur, who also made a huge amount of money, did out of Appcam.
Yes, I really like case studies. I mean, in this sort of interweb age, and you tweet and I tweet and people write articles and all that kind of stuff, it can get a little bit abstract. But actually, as you say, what's happening, this is what happens.
Yeah.
And this is reality. It's not a TV show. This is actually what happens.
This is reality, exactly.
This is how it works. So we've talked a little bit about what it means for the entrepreneurs and businesses. It's a more efficient process, which must be a good thing. On the other side of the equation, what does it mean for investors in this kind of 3 to 5 year time horizon?
Angel investing has been an asset class that has been around for decades. It's nothing new. What's really new about equity crowdfunding is who has access to that asset class. And these are all individuals that are new to the asset class. And there's a huge amount of education that online investors need to go through. Now, business angels on average, according to Nessa, make 22% return year on year out of their portfolio.
Is this the one survey? Because this is one of my interesting hobby horses, having been in investment one way or another for 30 years and having seen the world full of people who say that investment works and they outperform and all this kind of stuff, I'm incredibly skeptical. And there was a survey which has been quoted about why investing in small, early stage companies is a great idea. And I think it was maybe involved a word like Nesto, and it was definitely some small thing. And I actually read it, and it was a very small sample over a short period of time, and the return was quite good. On a previous show, Richard Gould of Reg Lawrence Graham, who I think is the leading fintech lawyer in London in terms of the deals they do on that, he cut his teeth at 3i in the beginning, and I know 3i a little bit. And 3i have been, you know, the venture capital and early stage development capital thing since the Second World War, and so they've got a hell of a long experience, and they know what they're doing, etc., etc. And it tends to be the case, I believe, so I'm always interested in talking about the sort of data behind it. It tends to be the case that I believe that not unsurprisingly, investing in early stage companies is not just risky, as you're supposed to say for the FCA, but incredibly risky. And sometimes it can work incredibly well, but generally it doesn't. And I personally believe that, you know, a portfolio of 10, 20, 30 years of these early stage companies, if you maximally diversify, it's not necessarily a good idea. You know, my personal approach is much more like lottery tickets. You know, I think it was an interesting business. I think it could go somewhere,
yeah,
but I'm not going to sit there and measure it against the FTSE in 10 years' time. And I have heard a leading platform on Bloomberg TV say, as long as investors diversify, then they'll be okay. But that seems to me to misapply a logic, which is that you only diversify on the FTSE because then you get the FTSE performance. And FTSE performance has been very good over a long period of time. If you diversify in lottery tickets, you lock in underperformance. And angels don't diversify, do they? They don't have like 100 investments.
No, so they follow different strategies.
Yeah.
They diversify, but it's very important not to confuse diversify by just spreading money around.
Yeah, what's the other definition of diversify? Because well, that's how I generally confuse it.
Diversify, but they picked which ones they invest in rather than just investing into 100 investments that they don't even kick the tires properly. They might diversify, but they might have 10, 20 businesses that they know very well. They diversify in that matter rather than just spraying and praying.
Okay, that's a good expression, isn't it? Okay, so it's a good point. So when you're talking about diversification, so then the key parameter is the number. You know, I've diversified into 100 investments on platforms. You've diversified into 10. It's both kind of diversification, but I would call the 10 portfolios personally as vocabulary.
Handpicked 10.
Yeah, exactly.
Against 100. So number one, whichever platform said that as long as you diversify, you're okay. I don't think they really should be saying that because it's not about diversification. It's about
I was shocked.
Getting a portfolio, which is very different. It's getting a portfolio. If you want to invest, you should invest as a portfolio rather than just one.
Yeah, exactly. Don't invest in one because that's a bit crazy. Unless it's just sort of for fun or it's your mate or you really want to back one business. But that's like backing one horse in one race when you go to the races.
If you just put your money in one, just assume that you're going to lose that money.
Exactly, yeah.
Right, and then it's fine if you want to do it. But it's all about a portfolio. And the really interesting part, it's about the research. It's not like out of every 100 small businesses that 10 actually make you a lot of money and you'll always get money. It's not about 100 small businesses. It's about 10 well-researched small businesses. And then you diversify amongst that group of well-researched companies. And that's the key differentiator between business angels and the crowd. If you diversify into 100 companies that thousands of other people are doing exactly the same thing.
Guess what?
You get companies that get funded, but they haven't necessarily been researched properly.
Yes, it's very well put, Gonzalo. So if you imagine these sort of scales, on the one hand, you've got these sort of the companies, on the other hand, the investors. Some ways of approaching it, and I think the marketplace as a whole tends to go in this fashion, tend to tilt the advantage to the companies raising the money. And it's going to be quite a while before the penny drops, like years and years and years and years, that, hey, me and all my friends invested in loads of equity crowdfunding things, do you know what? We made no money. And then, you know, the industry goes off it. Having the balance, and this is, I think, the thing that stock exchanges do very well, having the balance between investors and companies is at the crux of making a stable long-term marketplace, isn't it?
In a way, it's the negotiation between the lead investor and the company, right? It's when you get that balance or the closest you can get to that balance.
Yes. No, exactly. So I entirely agree, as I said up front, you know, you guys have got a very, very interesting solution to that. I'm sure, you know, other ways will approach. But the main point, going back to what you were just telling us about, and I agree, is to invest in well-researched companies. Because that's the other thing which tends to be, you know, down this triangle, down towards the pile and the high and sell them cheap. Oh, look, buy this one, it's a quid. Buy this one, it's 55p. Buy this one, it's 2.99 or something like that. And as you say, you spray and parade your money around. Now, you know, none of us are allowed to give advice, but, you know, I think that just based on my experience, that is one strategy, and I wouldn't necessarily use that strategy myself.
Well, I can't comment which strategy people should use as an FCA-regulated entity, but I have no doubt that out of even pure equity crowdfunding platform where there's no one carrying out proper research, there will be some winners. There will be businesses that will do well and will return huge amounts to investors.
It's like a roulette wheel. It's very hard to know from the outside. Having been a professional fund manager, ran a fund management business, having invested my own money for a long time, you know, that is much more akin to roulette. People have this fantasy still, and I can't believe how much people are paid in fund management, you know, that you can actually have fund managers who look at BP rather than Shell, and, you know, they're so clever that they decide stuff that the market doesn't know, and they invest in BP, not Shell, and they outperform and all that kind of stuff. Well, again, the data just doesn't support it. I mean, where we got into this was, I think you were quoting this study from Nesta, but when I've asked people in the past, what's the evidence that investing in this as an asset class is good return, then I've only ever been shown one study, which I thought was pretty flimsy, frankly, compared to 10, 20, 30 years in Europe as a whole, in UK and in US of early stage development capital.
I deal with a lot with business angels, and I know their portfolios, which I can't disclose for confidentiality reasons. There's actually one...
Can you disclose it if I turn the microphone off and tell me what to invest
in? No, there's one, actually. I even wrote a Forbes article about it, and people Google my Forbes article about it. He's called Jonathan Milner, and he has about 30-odd investments. Out of four have already successfully exited. I think two have gone bust. But out of the four that successfully exited, he has already covered his entire investment portfolio, plus 60, I can't remember the exact number, but it was about 64% on top of that. So he's already positive, and he still has 20-odd companies still going, some better than others, but he's already positive. And I know about a lot of business angels that are very successful at making money out of angel investment. Now, what we need to be careful is not to confuse that business angel and equity crowdfunding being the same asset class necessarily, because they both invest into unlisted companies, but the amount of research, the amount of tire kicking that goes on angel investment, and also the amount of negotiation of the terms is very different from what goes on the typical equity crowdfunding platform, the company-led platforms. So although it's in both investing into unlisted companies, are they the same asset class? I don't know. I don't know the right answer.
I like your distinction. I haven't particularly heard it made. I mean, because of this whole focus on securities rather than the process, again, going back to fund management, you'll have the bond department and the equity department and all that kind of stuff. But actually, what you're talking about is that, you know, you may have the same type of security or asset class and it be equity, but actually the process that has gone through to relate to that basically ends up rendering it almost a different kind of asset class, you know? And this isn't a good metaphor, but never mind. It's been a hot day. You're a bit saying, so I'm just caricaturing this to simplify the basic essence. On the one hand, the spray and pray, and you go to the races, not knowing much about horses, and you chuck your money around. You diversify, because that's like this politically correct. Diversify. You put it on all the horses. Well, you know, it's a bit like going to a casino. You may win some money, but over a long time you won't, because actually somebody's taking money out of the process. In the middle, and what you're saying is actually, if you're going to go to the horse races, well, you might as well follow the experienced people who bet on horses and have got a good track record. Now, where this metaphor breaks down is that the horses, I assume, well, maybe I'm very naive here, it's relatively difficult to affect the horse by just betting on it. However, if you're an angel investor with lots of entrepreneurial experience and you're sitting on some board, you can then actually add value. And it's this process of adding value that I think does generate the upside from otherwise what's just kind of a lottery ticket.
Correct, I would fully agree. And there's also an important distinction, which is, I don't like when it's compared to sort of betting on horse races, because, or casinos.
I saw you frowning, actually, so I started jogging backwards halfway through that metaphor.
The reason for that is that betting is a whole ecosystem whereby you put some money in, you bet some money in, someone is a middleman that has to take a percentage out, and actually what goes into that cake and what comes out is always smaller, yes, because someone has to take a cut. Whereas equity crowdfunding or unlisted companies investing, what you put in might be much smaller, much larger than what comes out, because even though, of course, there are intermediaries taking a cut, there's no upper limit on what comes out of a company. Some companies give 30, 40x return.
No, indeed. Well, this is the whole venture capital argument, isn't it? Which is, you know, all this unicorn bullshit and all this kind of stuff. And of course, that's completely true. It just happens to be the case, and there have been lots of articles in the HBR.org recently on this. It just happens to be the case that, take America, for example, which had an amazing tech boom in the last 15 plus years. Actually, the average return from the average VC is crap. So, you know, again, I'm just somebody who's got 30 years of skepticism of being a fund manager. So, going back to the industry as a whole, I mean, we've spoken about this, and I wrote my brilliant article, which got lots of private praise and lots of people I didn't know tweeting it, all that kind of stuff, and everybody looking at their shoes, because, as always, if you say the right things about the emperor not having any clothes, it doesn't particularly go down well. And I think I focused on sort of three areas. One of them is very close to your heart. I know this whole A, B, C, D, E, F share stuff. We don't want to go into detail, because I assume the average person listening to this has heard me bang on about it before. what I called DD. I had three examples of DD, one of which was not allowed to go through to Alt Fine News, which is, of course, DD is a breast size, but again, that's not politically correct to mention that. Also, DD is a Vietnam War slang for to run away, which may well be appropriate for some of the spivier platforms. But more importantly, of course, DD is due diligence, which you mentioned a little bit. And then I think the third angle, which is really interesting, of anybody speaking to any of the platforms or looking at investing, is not this kind of politically correct, you may lose all your money, and no, they've ticked the box, but what processes is a given platform putting in place to try and reduce the risk that the investors are taking. So I don't know whether you want to pick some of those three and agree entirely with me, Gonzalo.
Well, starting backwards, so the DD, the due diligence DD one, I think that one obviously varies from platform to platform, and I cannot comment on other platforms' due diligence, but...
Is it transparent? Because we had this conversation. When I was looking, I did a little research, which is probably 5 minutes on the internet, but it wasn't immediately obvious to me that platforms were actually being completely explicit about these are all the processes we go through. Going back to the evolution of the industry, going back to 3 or 5 years' time, do you think people are going to have to be more clear about what they're doing?
Well, so platforms will have to be a lot more transparent, and investors will demand that transparency. Yeah. What exactly are you, Mr. Platform, looking at?
Exactly. I just want to know. So I come to your platform or somebody else. Look, what have you done? I'm not going to judge you. I just want to know how much you've done.
Exactly, as you should. As a general rule, I think every platform is doing, or definitely should be doing, the basic, for example, legal due diligence. Do those directors exist?
I've seen, again, it's interesting for listeners, if you want to try this exercise yourself, you can actually go look at the key platforms. I've seen a platform, very well known, which says we don't do any due diligence on mini bonds, we take the company's numbers on trust. And I thought, shit.
Ah, I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah. This comes back to my point about standards of professionalism in the industry vary at the moment. Yeah?
Yes.
And fintech is still quite young. It's my contention that it needs to become just new financial services and more solid and more robust. So, you know, presumably we can agree that in 3 to 5 years' time, all of this has been tightened up. You know, there's some loose nuts that it needs tightening up. The FCA will have had 15 consultation papers, beaten a few people up, some will have gone bust and all this kind of thing. But it will, we assume, come out of it more robust.
I think so. So taking back what I said about what platforms did, because I wasn't aware that platforms don't carry out any due diligence.
Well, I'm sure most of them carry out most of the due diligence most of the time. It's just a question of transparency, as you
exactly.
say.
Exactly. But I think that, number one, the market itself will tell and should tell. You know, online investors should know if a platform has been around for months or years or whatever and they haven't really carried out any DD or they haven't actually cared, to be honest, about their members and their online investors, then you should just start walking away from that platform and just stop using it. In terms of the class of shares, so that one is one that, as you know, gets me.
You've written extensively on Forbes, and I've written about it, so I think maybe we'll include it in the show notes. And when I was talking to Karen in January from Cedars, she made the same point about the difference between A and B shares. So
I'm not going to go into any detail explaining what the differences are, because there's plenty of information out there. I just think that having B-class shares for the crowd and then A-class shares or preference shares for others is a little bit like treating your own members as second-class citizens.
Absolutely.
It's completely unacceptable.
Yeah.
And people have to realize that it distorts the financial returns. You might invest in exactly the same company. You know, some investors that get preference shares or whatever shares they get can have a huge return. And you, although you invested exactly the same time, exactly the same company, you may even lose money.
No, indeed. We're all agreed on that one. I mean, you know, before we move on to syndicate, room time's going on. One of the other things which it seems to me, which equity crowdfunding is slightly lagging the debt crowdfunding, is on provision of data on their websites about what's been going on with their portfolio or the companies that have passed through it. You know, I quite like to go to a platform and they say, we've, you know, done 1,000 raises, of which 57.4 companies have gone bust, one's gone public, and, you know, the rest are goodness knows what.
Correct. So we've been pushing quite a lot for this transparency in the sector, which I think it's lacking a lot.
What process do you think, again, going back to future equity crowdfunding, the thing that I'm missing at the moment is what process will lead the industry to becoming more transparent?
I think the process that would really help would be an independent source of collecting data and actually analysing it and putting the results out there.
So, for example, AltFi data.
For example.
Rupert Taylor was on the show. In the autumn, they're collecting increasing amounts on the debt crowdfunding side, and I'm sure they'd be very happy to collect increasing amounts on the equity side. Mm. And then you've got some independent third party producing indices and data. And again, then the investors know that there's some source.
AltFi data does a great job at analyzing that data. And it should go one step further. someone independent that would actually check which companies get funded and then what happens with those companies. We'd have a huge amount of data.
Yes, okay, so there's a big gap in the marketplace there. I'm not quite sure how they're going to monetize it. And it's quite close to my heart because I've been busily writing all these articles, insightful, witty, amusing and entertaining, no doubt, about risk in the alternative finance space. And it's nice getting the nice feedback, but a lot of fintechs aren't exactly motivated motivated to hire me to help them raise the standards, which is a little bit sad, not just for me, but for the industry. A lot of them say, oh, well, we follow the regulation. Well, you know, I've seen regulation for quite a while, and it tends to lag quite a lot. So it's not entirely clear. I think maybe there's more professional money coming in, then that will increase standards, because they will just ask for more stuff like this. So going on to the syndicate room, I mean, actually, we've mentioned a number of times it's cropped up, the key difference in your case, which is that you are angel investor-led. You mentioned this very interesting perspective, which is that angel investment into a segment is different from the spray and pray investment into the segment. And I entirely agree with the point about one would assume that good angels get better returns, and not least of which, because in terms of process, they're actually adding value to the companies. And I've seen that myself sitting on boards, and equally I've seen people not add value sitting on boards. So where do you see syndicate room going forward in the next few years, Gonzalo?
I think that investor-led model is the only model that could work in equity crowdfunding.
Oh, that's a pretty bold claim. So basically, in 3 to 5 years, everyone's going to have to copy you.
No. There will still be other platforms around, no doubt about it, and other models, and probably new models that we don't even know about yet. But I think when you compare company-led with investor-led, the whole industry has to be sustainable for investors for it to survive for 5 years, right? And I truly believe that the investor-led model is the only model that is sustainable for investors. It's the only model that investors will make money out of some of the investments further down the line, which will effectively recycle capital, and the whole industry will keep on going, and not only going, actually growing very, very significantly. But it has to be sustainable for investors.
It's interesting because, I mean, previously I'd kind of obviously, you know, thought of you guys as an equity crowdfunding platform, because that's the word that tends to go around. But you might say, if you're splitting hairs, or maybe not even splitting hairs, if you're making important distinctions, that of course you are that somewhat, but actually you're kind of more of an angel investing platform. You're halfway between the two.
Well, to be honest, no, I think we're more of an angel investing platform. What we've done is just we lowered the threshold of angel investing to £1,000.
Yeah. Well, there we go. You should give me a big check afterwards, because I've just given you some free brand consulting about how to create clear blue water between you and everybody else. And so without disclosing all your sort of difficulties in life, what are the sort of biggest challenges for you over the next year about growing syndicate room?
So one of them is education of online investors. As I said, it's an existing asset class that is being opened to new people that have seen this asset class for the first time. And people need to learn, for example, what does it mean, the investor-led model, and what are potential benefits and what terms are and so on. That's one of the challenges. The other challenge will be, as the industry matures, what do people want to see in front of their eyes? What type of investments? And make sure we're one step ahead. And, you know, there are very, very bright people working in this industry and all competing for the same market. But I think also the challenge of making sure that the industry keeps on growing and actually treats investors fairly, so that, again, it carries on being sustainable for investors. That's one of the things we're really going to push for, as well as what you mentioned before, which is the transparency. You know, we really want to push platforms to be transparent about what they fund and what happens with those companies, because it works, well, in our case, it works massively in our favor when they can compare track records. Now, one of the things I wanted to talk about is what's the difference? So we are, as you mentioned, an angel investing platform that we've lowered the threshold to £1,000. Why is that different from pure equity crowdfunding platforms? And you can really tell if you look at the deals and the type of deals that get funded via Syndicate Room. They tend to be a lot more technical. They tend to be not the sexy consumer product. Yeah. They tend to be a lot more, I would argue, sophisticated. You know, a lot of intellectual property behind them that protects their market share. So we've done a third of our deals has been in healthcare. Very, very complex businesses, some of them, that have done very well. A fourth of our deals have been in engineering.
Right, okay. So these are real solid stuff.
They are.
Going back to civil engineering background.
Yeah, and they are the type of investments that business angels like to invest in. Business angels don't like to invest in businesses that don't have a way of protecting their market share, right? And that's very different from what you see from crowdfunding. And then the difference on the outcome as well, we've funded just over 30 businesses so far, and they're still all going. I have no doubts that some of them, unfortunately, will end up going bust. But the fact that 18 months on, every single one of them is still going.
So that's another statistic, isn't it? I'd like to see on all the sites.
I would love to see platforms publishing information about what's happening with the deals that they funded, because success is not measured by the number of businesses that you fund, and the amount of money going in is actually how much comes out at the other end.
That sounds like it should be on a sort of Chinese fortune cookie. Mm. Success is not measured by number of money going in, yeah. Amount of money coming out.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And finally, the other big difference is the percentage of success of companies being funded. Over 80% of the businesses that get listed on Syndicate Room, so that pass our due diligence, go on to get funded. That's an astonishingly high percentage.
Compared to an industry average of circa?
Our numbers show an average of about 10 to 12%.
Wow.
And we're talking about 82% in our case.
Gosh, so all this rubbish I was saying at the beginning about how wonderful you are, you actually do sound like you're kind of wonderful.
Yeah, thank you.
So, good. Okay, on that note.
On that bombshell.
Yeah, exactly. On that bombshell. So that's been very interesting, Gonzalo, and one of the things that I hope that the listeners have got out of this is that behind apparently simple phrases, as they will know already, words like debt crowdfunding, there are some very different models, very different businesses out there. And the same thing is also applying behind the words equity crowdfunding. You know, you really need to drill into this kind of thing, and it is slightly fractal in nature. From a distance it looks simple, then you get closer, it looks as equally complex, and you get closer, it looks equally complex. But I certainly admire what you guys are doing, and I think it's a, you know, very, very interesting idea, and I wish you every luck in executing it and making it successful in the future.
Excellent. Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app, or sign up at londonfintechpodcast.com for email alerts and new episodes. Live long and prosper.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. To come away from the city, with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, with the faces so grey, with the pain of the everyday. The mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. City goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me. 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 Watch the firelight.